Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to History in Technicolor, with me, Wolf O'Neill, and you...
David Crowther. Isn't it called The History in Technicolor?
Be quiet. Okay. So here we are on another adventure with us.
Indeed.
Two men in a shed.
It is an adventure, isn't it? We never know where we're going to go.
Well, I hope we do, because we plan this.
That is true. That's a fair point. And in fact, in this one, we've done it before. So
yes.
Go.
So, the film that I've selected today is Selma, the 2014 film. It chronicles the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. during the campaign to secure equal voting rights, which culminated in the march from Selma to Montgomery in Alabama, and President Johnson signing the Voting Rights Bill in 1965.
Excellent. So you always say something.
Why
do we never remember this? Hey, Wolf, why did you select this movie today?
Wow, David, thank you for asking.
Don't mention it. More than a couple of times.
I've selected this because the film was very well received, and I sadly missed it upon its release, so I'd always wanted to make amends for this. It has a stellar cast, full of extraordinary actors working at every level, and is directed by Ava DuVernay, who became the first black woman to ever be nominated for the Best Director Award at the Golden Globes. Which is frankly shocking, but there you go.
Why, wasn't she very good?
No, because she's good, but...
Being funny.
Oh, I see. You just can't laugh about this kind of thing,
sorry,
David.
Sorry, pardon me. You're right. You're so right.
Then, from a history perspective, I wanted to turn our attention. That's David whipping himself with a birch twig, I assume.
Indeed.
He's not naked, fortunately for me.
Which is a good thing, yeah.
I wanted to turn our attention to civil rights. Mm-hmm. We haven't really looked at it before. We're trying to examine all different aspects of history from all over the world. And the civil rights movement in America is one of the most important and continually vital and relevant moments of history in the 20th century.
Yeah. That's a good reason. That's not a bad reason to be studying a film, is it? Yeah, that's fine. That's good. Yeah.
So a quick little bit of prehistory.
Like it is.
In 1964, the Civil Rights Act was finally passed, legally desegregating the South and outlawing discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. This came about as a result of the nonviolent direct action in Birmingham, Alabama, which was led by Dr. King and other members of the Southern Christian leadership. Despite this act, racial segregation continued to be enforced via the Jim Crow laws, which mandated that racial segregation in all public facilities in the former Confederate states.
So when you say Jim Crow laws, were they laws specifically introduced by...
A man named Jim Crow,
yeah.
Yeah.
So and when were they introduced? Are they contemporary with this action sort of thing as a response to this movement?
So,
or were they traditional laws that had been created back in the days of slavery
They came after the Civil War.
Okay.
Because they're in former Confederate states.
Okay.
So they're specifically created
right.
to force racial segregation in public facilities.
Okay.
And they were in effect. Then the Civil Rights Act was passed, but they continued to exist.
Right. Okay.
Gotcha. On kind of a state level.
Cool.
As far as I know. The result of this was that in many areas, African Americans were essentially prohibited from registering to vote, removing their voices and suppressing them. So in Selma, which is in Dallas County, African Americans made up more than half of the population, but had only 2% of the registered voters. Now, this was not because they didn't want to vote. They were trying by the hundreds and thousands to vote, as is shown in the film. And they just simply weren't allowed. So they had to, you know, the tests that they have to do at the start. They have to go through all of these tests. And even if you passed all of the tests, which were very hard, way harder than anyone who was an American citizen was expected to know, they still were often declined for various reasons. It's
quite
interesting.
That's quite a good scene, isn't it, in the film where she goes in and she answers all the questions and yet he still
And then he gives her more questions which aren't she's not prepared for because they're he's just had to make something up on the spot to stop her.
And it's good because it's quite a simple way of understanding, you know, the day-to-day banality of the frustration of not being able to get the right to vote. You know, these things are always, quite rightly, build up as a as these big, you know, heroic, massive things. One of the nice things about the film was that it showed you the day-to-day banality of it all. You know, the frustration of going in and not being able to receive what is rightfully yours.
And it's really important to reinforce the kind of institutional racism and suppression that's happening, because this man is not saying horrible things to her necessarily. Yeah. He isn't using the language we might initially associate with such a traumatic experience.
Yeah.
He's simply using the power that he has in his job to prevent this person from achieving any rights.
And that's absolutely right. And that's what I think I mean by the banality of it all. It's very day-to-day, isn't it? It's just, you know, it's constant.
The heroic nature of what's happening is we already know that she's done this multiple times and she keeps getting rejected. It's going to continue to happen. And yet, despite what she's facing, she will return home and she will study again more than she ever has any right to have to do. She shouldn't have to do that. She's going to study more and she's going to return again to try and do it. It's very impressive. So just to finish off, in Selma, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee had struggled tirelessly to register black voters in the county seat until Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. arrived, backed by the Southern Christian leadership, and they joined the cause, which led to the events of the film.
Very good. Shall I ask you a question now? Yes. What did this get in Metacritic? What score?
So I'm
going to... On a scale of 1 to 100.
I think before, I guessed...
With 100 being good.
Because we are repeating this episode. Yes. I think I guessed 90, so I'm going to go with that again.
88. It's not bad.
Oh, okay.
And actually, for Rotten Tomatoes, it gets 99%.
Right. That was the one I was confusing it with. Yeah, it's very, very accurate.
Got a good response.
And very highly praised. Mm. So, I think first and foremost, when it comes to this film, it's worth talking about how incredible the cast is, at least for me. They're truly exceptional and a delight to watch. Did you have any particular performances or characters that you really liked, David?
Well, I'm going to go for the obvious, unfortunately. I'm going to go for David Oyelowo. I'm sorry about that. You mocked me last time. We stopped talking about it last time. Just to explain everybody, we recorded it on the wrong mic. It sounded like a pile of poo, so we thought we'd have to do it again.
Well, so you say we, but it was you.
So Wolf forgot to remind me to change the microphone, so we've had to do it all again. So that's why we keep saying we've done it before. David Oyelowo I thought was very good, because I liked in particular that he made the speeches sing. You know, for me that was when the movie really got going, actually, where he got a motive.
Did you feel like you were watching an actor act?
No, I thought that was the great thing about him. Funnily enough, I'm not sure I said this now, but funnily enough, one of the problems of the film, not problems of the film, but because it was done at a very practical, straightforward, unhysterical level, correspondingly, I never quite got that emotionally involved with it. You know, when you're watching something, which is quite outrageous, really, you know, you expect to get more emotionally involved than I personally did, and therefore... The reason I picked David is that those speeches bit is where you get quite a lot of emotion, because you get that, you know, that fantastic response from the crowd. It's a, you know, it's almost like it's a bit of theatre rather than just a speech, because you've got it's two way because of that tradition, of that Christian tradition. So I thought that was the bit where I felt most emotionally engaged.
Interesting. That I've jotted down a question. Okay. I'm going to ask you that to follow up in a little bit. But I just want to finish with the
42.
With the cast.
Okay.
That's your answer, okay?
You, that is my answer.
Thank you, Douglas Adams. There are, for me, there are too many highlights in right. the film. Lakeith Stanfield is becoming a really prominent actor at the moment. He plays Jimmy Lee Jackson, which is quite a small role in the film, but he absolutely nails it and has a great presence. Wendell Pierce is probably my favourite, but that's just because I really like him as an actor. Right. He's from The Wire, so he's an absolute delight in everything. You have the welcome appearance of Tessa Thompson. Andre Holland and Coleman Domingo provide great support as Young and Abernathy. And Stephen James, who was most recently in If Beale Street Could Talk, gives, for my money, maybe the best performance, at least after David Oyelowo, as John Lewis, who is the leader of the kind of student voting rights committee, who then leads the march across the bridge. And he has a really interesting character arc because him and his colleague don't initially want the assistance of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the others because they believe that if they work hard enough, they can achieve what they want to do on their own.
Yeah.
And they're worried this is going to bring problems to the community. But over time, they realize they have to adjust their viewpoints and their understandings about how they're going to achieve civil rights and work with this cause. And he then leads this march into certain danger.
Mm.
And I think, and his journey throughout is fascinating.
Yes, I mean, I think that's quite, again, a very good thing about the film is that you get that interplay of the local, and it's not an A versus B film, although it is to a degree an A versus B movie. It's there's an A and they've got these problems with B, and then C thinks that, and D really should be doing that. You know, it doesn't feel like a set piece designed to hammer one message in a way. It wants to show you more under the bonnet of how things went on.
And isn't it interesting how our last film was Henry V, this national hero, this icon. Dr. Martin Luther King, in many ways, is as prominent a figure. Yeah. But throughout this film, there's a lot more opposition to him from his own side, from Malcolm X, from other people who have different views on how they're going to achieve their rights, as well as conflicts within himself. It's a more, maybe even a more balanced, less nationalistic depiction.
I mean, I think that's true, although I'm going to say two things.
Yes.
One is Henry V was a monarch. So you didn't say, Henry, really, you're wrong on this one. We're going to do this because you had your head chopped off. Well, I exaggerate for fact. And secondly, at the beginning of Henry V, you do get the fact that he kills his uncle, Richard of Cambridge, for treason.
Yes.
So there's a little bit of disagreement because...
But anyway, you understand my point.
I understand your point, exactly. And totally agree. That's the wonder of the film, is that you understand the currents and the points of difference going
on. And it would be very easy to rely on Dr. King's speeches and make this a very patriotic, inspiring film in that sense. And it really doesn't seem to go in that direction. It's a little bit more subdued and balanced.
Yeah, I agree. It's more functional. And as I say, it's not hysterical. You don't.
So while we just quickly round off the cast, for me, the slightly two weaker characters are the performances by Tom Wilkinson and Tim Roth, where they, for me, are a little bit more, I guess, less developed, more caricature, perhaps. Yeah. I wasn't a big fan of Tim Roth. I know you weren't a big fan of Tom Wilkinson.
I didn't understand it. Why have you got an English act? Why have you got so many English actors? I've never known who Tim Roth is, actually, because he gets quite a lot of dislike on the line, in which I spend far too much time. Tim Roth's really boring. Oh, he's had a personality bypass, that sort of thing.
He's really good in Tarantino's films. So he's really good in Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction. He's really good in Rob Roy.
Rob Roy. People keep talking about Rob Roy. I've got to see this meme. I'm sure I saw it I was a lad. But how old is
he? He's the horrific, brutal nemesis of Liam Neeson's Rob Roy.
Ah, this is a more recent Rob Roy. Because I think the Rob Roy I saw, they had long hair and moustaches.
But they do.
In the 70s.
Oh, okay. So this is probably a 90s movie?
Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't have been watching Rob Roy in the 90s. Anyway, back to Selma. Tom Wilkinshaw.
What? Wilkinson?
What is his name?
Tom Wilkinson.
As in, Tom Wilkinson. I'm really not sure why they picked him. Why do you need an Englishman to do LBJ? But anyway, but you always felt he was doing an American accent. Because there is an American... Have you ever watched House?
Yes.
he does the same thing. The Brits, when they can't really do an American accent, do this kind of fake American accent, which is exactly the same.
Could you do an impression,
I was
David?
Just about to do an impression, then I realised what a mistake that would be. So they have this sort of accent, which is kind of identical, and it's just, you know, it's just rubbish. So you spend your whole time thinking, oh, he didn't quite get that, did he, Tom? I mean, it's like watching Mel Gibson, you know. And I didn't think he nailed it, and I think that the accent got in the way, and he was a bit unconvincing.
Okay. Which is interesting, because I'm guessing you don't have a particularly solidified vision of Lyndon B. Johnson.
No, but I just think he didn't feel that this... It's not that he didn't depict LBJ, although there's some controversy about that, as I understand it. He says she didn't think this is a real character. I love Tom Wilkinson. I mean, I love Tom Wilkinson. I would marry Tom Wilkinson if he
would
have
my baby. Because of the
Full Monty? Because of the Mul Fonty, yeah. I mean, you know, he's a bloody genius. But he... In this case, it
looking
didn't work.
For some hot stuff, baby, this evening.
You've watched it now, have you?
Well, I'm aware of the song.
Okay.
Well, I'm glad that rendition was absolutely perfect.
It was superb. Can we get back to Selma?
Now put your pants back on, David. One line of that song and the strip's begun.
Let's get back to Selma. Come on.
So just to finish up, this is maybe the film where we shouldn't be doing this, but... For me, the heart of the film is the pairing of David Oyelowo and Carmen Ejogo as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta King. Mm. It's their personal and spiritual struggles that ground us and guide us through the story. And because there's so many characters involved, a lot of them have to be... caricatures is maybe too negative, but they can't be as developed as you would like them to be because there's so many people involved.
Mm.
So they're just going to... depict the real people and do what they need to in the history of the events.
Yeah.
Whereas with these characters, we actually get to see their inner workings a little bit more and they're developed and rounded out. So for me, it's really interesting to see their quieter tribulations complement the shocking bursts of violence during the historic marches. It's not really a documentary as a film, obviously that's clear, but it is very, very accurate and heavily researched. And... can at times feel maybe like a kind of a by-the-book representation.
Yeah.
Done very well, admittedly. But it's moving through an event, giving you all the key points so you have all the information till you reach the end.
Yeah.
Did you feel... was it painful to watch? Did you feel outraged or upset?
So that's the thing I was saying earlier, that also you know the answer. You know, you kind of know what happens. And therefore you know that these people are going through this pain... and that there is a positive outcome at the end of it. Whereas, of course, they didn't. So there's always that problem of hindsight, which probably puts a skein between you and the emotion of it. I thought there was a real sense of tension and drama. So I think, you know, although I'm saying it's kind of felt for me non-hysterical in a way I never got as emotionally engaged as I expected to in it, there is a real sense of tension and drama in it. You know, you are seeing... you are dragged, pulled into it. And there's very realistic. So although you say it's not documentary, and clearly it isn't, it does feel quite documentary. You do feel as though you're going from A to B to C.
I raised it because there are some similarities, which is what I thought was worth addressing.
So, and with that, you do get a sense that you're seeing something which is true and you're getting a sense of realism. But as I said before, it's just that there's a bit of emotion that's not there that I would have expected to be there with such a subject.
Interesting. Do you think that it's a logical decision to try and not just go for this really emotive trigger?
Well, because it feels... I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, there's a broader discussion here about... I was having an argument with somebody recently about whether people should apologise for events in history. And actually, it seems to me... I'll try and make this relevant. There are some things which I think you can draw a straight line from... yesteryear to today. So I think it's perfectly reasonable for Britain to be apologising for the Great Famine in Ireland, for example. But the trouble with all of that is that what you do is turn an act of history into an emotional right and wrong. And of course, there are moral rights and wrongs in this, but the danger is that what you do is generate a lot of heat, a lot of defensiveness, you open a lot of reopen a lot of painful wounds, when actually what you need to do is forgive, and not quite forget, but move on. So there is a cost, it seems to me, in making films which are very emotional about, hey, there was this terrible wrong, and we we overturned it. There's a great right in that too, because these are very brave people who did amazing things. But there is a cost. Am I making any sense whatsoever? I'm not sure I'm answering a question.
I think you are making sense. Maybe I disagree slightly, mm-hmm. at least in terms of this respect, because it's such a prevalent and current yeah. issue. We aren't past it.
No.
And it's not been resolved. So to... It staggers me how recent the events yeah. of this film actually are.
Yeah.
So when it finishes and there's no thinking, oh, I'm glad that was resolved, it's not resolved.
Mm.
And thus, I think it's still very current.
Yeah. So that has... I think that is very much my point, actually. That then, in a situation where you've got a great injustice... or if you've got difficult issues you need to deal with, how helpful is it to generate a lot of heat? And how much more useful is it to generate a lot of light? So from this film, you can understand that there are real personalities involved with real problems. There are real tactics involved. And it has to be said that the opponents of, you know, the people Martin Luther King is going up against are never presented in a positive light. You know, there's no complexity about, oh, they've got personal problems, this, that, and t'other. You know, they are straightforward, a bit of a cardboard cutout. These people are trying to prevent right injustice. My point is that it seems to me to be a very, very brave and sensible act to make a film like this, which does take some of the emotion out of it. Because, as you say, you're in a current situation which hasn't been fully resolved yet. So what value is there in creating a lot of heat? And therefore, because he gets in the way of a proper, mature discussion about, well, what are the rights and the wrongs here and what should or should we not be doing about it?
I think it is a relatively balanced depiction of the events. I think as we approach this, and we'll come on to this in a second, Dr. Martin Luther King is shown to be flawed and he is explored and examined. And I think that the role between Lyndon B. Johnson and him and their involvement and how the bill is passed is addressed to some extent. So there is shown to be some collaboration between the president and Dr. King and how that works. There's some antagonism too, but it's not completely ignored.
Yeah.
And they do develop quite a lot. I think what we've got is, if you want to tell the history of this event,
yeah,
you need to be faithful to the event, and that's what they do.
Yeah.
And you can't maybe have the emotional impact you would want to have if you were making an original story.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. That's a good point, actually, the difference between something which is clearly looking at a series of real events and something which is entirely fictional.
Because that's something we come up across quite a lot in all these films we look at. Yes,
true.
The times when sometimes the film has to deviate from history in order to make the emotional impact that the filmmakers, or the political impact that the filmmakers want to have.
Yeah.
Because the constraints of the actual events prevent them from doing it.
Yeah.
And... often you can tell when a film is trying to be more original than historical because that's its goal. Yeah,
indeed. I think that's right.
And this one is very historical.
It is very historical, and I think there's a big value in that. It was interesting what you were just saying about the strategic nature of what they're doing. That was one of the most interesting things in the film for me, actually, which is kind of feels a bit cold. But the fact that you kind of think about these events in terms of, you know, a historic struggle against truth, justice, light, you know, blah, blah. And in actual fact, what it also was, I mean, it kind of was that, but it was also a very practical series of decisions. And they, fascinating, Martin Luther King refers to a previous event where the governor had handled it in a very clever way by not being violent, by arresting people in a very humane, unviolent way. And that was a problem for him because then they hadn't been able to get the media reaction they wanted. And therefore, they picked this area because the governor they knew was going to react in a very violent way, or the police chief. So that tactical interplay thing, and as you say, the local student association didn't really want this to happen here and how they changed, that was all really interesting.
And it's really important to... Well, it's really interesting to examine how this is happening all over the South in particular, the rest of the country as well to some extent. But until people are being beaten in the streets and filmed, so it can be sent to you in your television set at home, you're unaware of it.
Yeah.
That certain sense of turning a blind eye.
Yeah.
The president seems to be doing that. Lots of people seem to know that this is happening, but it's not their number one priority, so they're going to ignore it. Whereas for these people, it's an everyday struggle.
Yeah.
And they have to strategically work out how they can get help, how they can alert people so that people will respond to them and support them.
Yeah, indeed. It's a battle. It's a war that has to be planned in the same way.
How did you feel about the film's portrayal of Dr. Martin Luther King? I know we've addressed it.
I thought it was really good. I mean, he came across as a real person. You saw his talent as well, you know, his communication skills. You saw that there was the thing I went slightly wrong on about whether it had an affair or not, because when I watched it, he's being bugged by the FBI. Don't know if we're moving on to the wrong bit, but he, you know, I thought that was a setup and that he hadn't actually had an affair, but you think that actually he had an affair. So I got that wrong. But, you know, that worked its way naturally into the movie, and you kind of judged him accordingly, I think.
But even slightly, okay, if we take that out, let's say, because we're going to quibble over it a little bit, do you feel that he has shown...
I wouldn't argue with you, Wolf.
Okay. do you feel that he has shown to have disagreements within himself about how he needs to carry, how he needs to lead, how he needs to inspire, guilt that he's dealing with? For example, there's the scene, he doesn't lead the initial march. Mm. Remember, he goes home to deal with his family problems and to go to his church. And then they all get attacked on the bridge.
Mm.
This is a real struggle for him to know what to do, how to lead it, how to manage himself and reconcile his own issues.
You don't get the feeling that this is a person of absolute certainty. He was kind of a god who just knew exactly what was going to he was going to do, and this is why he did it. He came across as a real character. But on the other hand, I didn't get any great feelings of, you know, personal laceration. So the bit at the bridge where he turns round, he's very clear about why. And actually, he's not agonising about why. He's saying, look, I don't want people to get killed. And in that situation, I thought they would do. So I turned back. Get over it. That was the impression I got.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't get the impression he was thinking, oh, this is terrible. I don't. You know, he came across as a decisive kind of man. He knew what he wanted to achieve.
Yeah, I think he has to be decisive. I think I just mean that I can see enough suggestions that it's not all perfectly planned out and easy for him to do this.
Absolutely.
There's the scenes where he has to... Remember the scene where they're standing there and they're watching the police assault that older woman, drag her to the floor, and he's trying to maintain his composure.
Yeah.
And he can't break from his line to run over and help. He's trying to maintain his composure because he needs to let this happen in order for awareness to be raised. And that goes against everything that he wants to do as a human being and as an individual.
Mm.
But he's committed to his direction and he has to
go
through with that. His arguments with Malcolm X
are
significant and important.
Yeah.
The divide in the in the
within
movement.
The camp, indeed. And the, of course, the debate with you know, LBJ about what they should be doing and what their role is together. Are we talking about historical accuracy? Are we moving out into the...
Historical accuracy. So I think to begin with, it should be made clear that this is... overall, very accurate, thoroughly researched. There are a few key talking points, which we'll come to. With the truce, which I'll kind of go through quickly, Jimmie Lee Jackson was murdered by state troopers in the nearby town of Marion while trying to protect his family from being clubbed. He didn't die at the scene, died a few days later in hospital, but that's quibbling over something inconsequential. The impact that scene has is very powerful and important. I think it's the right decision to make that adjustment. The man from Boston, James Reeb, who was a minister and a pastor, he was savagely beaten to death by white segregationists. Interesting fact, no one was ever convicted for this crime. The four men that were indicted as suspects were all acquitted by an all-white jury.
Right.
And even if the evidence found now proves their guilt, because they of the way the court case went and the fact that a number of them have died now, they can never be recharged. Governor Wallace did order state troopers to use whatever means necessary to prevent a march, and the attacks on the Edmund Pettus Bridge are hauntingly realised. The TV cameras caught it all, and the footage was sent to New York, distributed that night as breaking news, and streamed to 50 million Americans, which did galvanise support and awareness. Interestingly, the Edmund Pettus Bridge is named after a Confederate general and a once-time Grand Dragon of the Alabama KKK.
Good Lord.
So that's being... the bridge is now remembered for something new, something positive.
It's still called the Edmund Pettus Bridge, is it?
Yeah. I think they're not going to change the name because it's important that they're...
Else, yeah. And also that connection actually makes it even more real. Actually.
Also, it's a mark against him, really.
Yeah.
That he was the person he was, and now his bridge is remembered for this.
Yeah.
J. Edgar Hoover is presented fairly ruthlessly in the film, but I think that's relatively accurate, at least in this setting. He was racist and seemed actively determined to take down Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He supposedly went to great lengths to establish a communist connection, because obviously that would have allowed them to really attack with much more force. He wanted to neutralize Dr. King, and this included monitoring him, recording his calls, sending incriminating tapes to Coretta, calling her, which is all the stuff that we see in the film. The text from the actual FBI monitoring is produced on the screen quite a lot. And the cherry on the top of it all, really, which is quite petty, is that after Dr. King was assassinated, his birthday was proposed to be made a national holiday, and he forcibly tried to have this prevented and stopped.
Right.
He was a man who cared so little about him that he really thought he didn't deserve any recognition for what he'd achieved.
Right.
And then we get onto the main point here, which is really the key argument against the film, and this is how President Lyndon B. Johnson is depicted and how his involvement in the acts is shown and his relationship with Dr. King. So, President Johnson's assistant, Joseph Califano Jr., alleges that Johnson and King were partners and that Johnson was enthusiastic about voting rights and major demonstrations. But this goes against the kind of general depictions, especially shown in the film. Then LBJ's historian, Mark Updegrove, believes the film also mischaracterizes the president, arguing that based off of recorded phone calls from 1965, Johnson was far more cooperative and even came up with some of the suggestions about their course of action, which is interesting.
Right,
because that's definitely not shown in the film.
No, definitely not. No.
But then contrastingly, Eric Goldman, who's a special consultant to Johnson, wrote in 1969 that, and this is a quote, he was no great admirer of Dr. Martin Luther King, among other reasons because he questioned how well his judgment would hold up over the long haul. He also wasn't enthusiastic about mass demonstrations. To a man of his mind, the African-Americans would do themselves more good working on their politicians for more beneficial legislation than holding demonstrations.
Right. So where is the truth in it? I mean, you can see why they took this line, in a way, can't you, in the film, that if you've got this alternative hero, does it detract from your main character? So if you've got two alternative historical lines available, dramatically, you might find that one is the best approach to take. I mean, obviously, you don't want to be untruthful, but if, you know, that's a current line of thought.
So, Ava DuVernay has been open about this.
Yeah.
And is clear that she has slightly reduced the role, the presence of Johnson in the film.
Right.
And reduced his role in leading to the passing of the Voting Rights Bill. But not inaccurately. She's simply decided that the world doesn't need another white savior, especially in this film.
Right. Okay.
And that that's the focus needs to be on the people in the story.
Mm.
Because there's actually quite a lot of focus given to everybody else other than Dr. King himself. Yeah. It's the people in Selma and their march and how that changes the world.
Yes, it's got to be said, this doesn't feel like a... It doesn't feel like a film about Martin Luther King. It feels like a movement, like a film about Selma and how it came about and the people who are involved.
He just happens to be the most significant person. So it does address their relationship. But she was like, the film is not about Johnson. So he's always has to be a supporting character. And thus, he cannot be as fully developed and rounded as some of the others.
Yeah.
So she believes, and this is a general consensus from these points of view that we've been looking at, that he was a reluctant hero.
Right.
Rather than this...
Who pulls through. Which is what you get in the film, isn't it? You always feel that he's being slightly disingenuous. He doesn't want to say, look, just go off, I've got other things to think about and can't be bothered about this right now. But, you know, that's kind of the impression you get that his heart isn't really in it.
I think it's totally believable and realistic and likely that although he has some decent parts to his personality and his character, the main reason that he's not trying to push this through, like he says in the film, is because he wants to achieve a lot in his presidency.
Yeah.
He needs the votes from the Southern Bloc and those Southern states to pass a lot of his... You know, I think he's got a green bill and a bunch of other bills. If he causes all this commotion early on, he's never going to be able to have a legacy that he wants to be remembered for and pass all these changes that he wants to implement. So he is strategically planning to delay the Voting Rights Bill until he's passed a bunch of other bills and everybody likes him. And then he, you know, puts his foot down and makes them do what he wants. obviously, Dr. King says, we can't do this. We need to act now.
Yeah.
This is too important. And Johnson kind of disagrees and wants to kind of put it on the back burner for as long as possible. This is what DuVernay's agreeing with.
Yeah.
So she's saying that he's a reluctant hero, dragged into this by the actions of Dr. Martin Luther King and the others, and that we should recognize their actions, appreciate what he did, and recognize that he did do something good, but not make him the focus.
Yeah.
I think that's fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
I mean, I don't know enough for history to argue, but it doesn't sound like an unreasonable decision to make.
No. And I looked up this data-based site, which is called Information is Beautiful, that studies the accuracy of films. Not all of them. Obviously, it was a few around the time that the Oscars was on.
Yeah.
They fact-checked them against sort of every scene versus whether they're true, mostly false, or it cannot be verified.
Yeah.
And they scored Selma as having 100%.
Oh, God.
Because it's only true, mostly true, or unknown.
Right.
And you can see that as it moves through each part and where the accuracy is happening. And essentially what they're saying is it's generally very true.
Right.
You can corroborate everything they do in the film with supportive evidence.
Right.
And it can at least be, you know, supposed that this is fairly accurate and likely to have been the case. Right. So even though we're having this disagreement, I think.
The facts are real. And presumably all the speeches are perfectly accurate.
Ah, yes. So this leads me on to a really interesting fact that I somehow skipped earlier. So all the dialogue in Dr. King's speeches had to be rewritten by the screenwriter due to copyright issues. So the King estate licensed the film rights exclusively for these speeches to DreamWorks and Warner Brothers with the purpose of Steven Spielberg making a film.
Which he hasn't made yet.
So
amazing, isn't it?
The real speeches had to be rewritten by the scriptwriter, but so that they still sounded like Dr. Martin Luther King. So they conveyed the same message, tone and voice, but by using different words.
That's amazing. I'd love to hear some, because I know the very famous I Have a Dream speech, but I don't know the speeches well enough to know whether they get the tone and the voice right, but it sounds as they've done a very good job, because nobody's being up in the arms saying...
I was very impressed.
I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, to me, they sounded fantastic. I've already mentioned them. I think they sounded great.
I mean, you clearly can't criticise them because they literally aren't allowed to use the actual words.
Yeah.
So
that is amazing, though, just to get to that point. I mean, how can that be? Surely they're in the public domain because they're on the telly or not. I mean, it seems incredible. And the fact that Steven Spielberg is sitting on the damn things. I mean, you'd have thought these are publicly important things that the nation ought to own.
And the fact that they're being kept from black artists making this film about this movement just so that Steven Spielberg can get another fat check in the future.
It's a bit of an outrage, isn't it? I think we're outraged in the shed. We're outraged in the shed.
I was very shocked, but I was so impressed with the writing that they were able to do that. And it didn't feel like, you know, fakes...
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, certainly to me it was very convincing. Somebody who knew more
very convincing.
Might not be. But
And what did you feel the lasting message of the film was? Did it give you this impression that everything was resolved?
No, it gave the impression that a step had been achieved. You know, a step on the way had been, a battle in the war had been won. And that it was significant. So, message of the film, what's the film about? Kind of question. Message of the movie. I suppose, I mean, it's the obvious one, that perseverance is, you know, will get you there in the end kind of thing, that right will out, I suppose.
I mean, I do think it's a fairly straightforward run-of-the-mill depiction of a series of historical events, and it's focused around that, and it just wants to tell that story because it knows that the facts are more important than anything else.
I think that is the thing.
They're going to have the impact, so it's going to do that. I think, interestingly, if you have seen Black Klansman, or even if you haven't, go watch it.
Yes, I put that on the list that I must go and see.
Absolutely my favourite film from last year.
Yeah, that's really good.
What's really interesting about that film is it also approaches a historical event, but it chooses to make it very, very present and current to now. And that's partly because it bookends the film with scenes where of an unknown time period, but also because it's constantly examining kind of the history of the movement and what's been happening and the impact it's having now. And it ends with a good few minutes of modern footage from the last year or two.
Right.
And It makes you think that everything's done, everything's sorted, this is great. We've defeated the bad guys, yeah. The KKK has been stopped. And then it shows you racist, white supremacist right. activity in America right now.
Right.
In a series of shocking video footage. Obviously, we've seen before as well, yeah. but it's very powerful. It grabs you and it shakes you and it lets you know that this isn't,
yeah,
this isn't over.
Sorted, yeah.
And it's a very powerful piece of filmmaking right. and I highly recommend it. And it's just a very different approach to how it wants to convey that message.
Yeah.
But it's a very different type of film and that would stand out in a film yeah. like this, I believe.
Very good.
What would you give the film as a rating?
I would give it a 7, Wolf.
I would agree.
Since you ask me.
I put down 7 or an 8. I think it is important to point out, if we've sounded negative, we both really enjoyed
it. Yeah, I don't mean to sound negative at all. I really enjoyed the movie. It was very convincing. It's the same thing, as I said, there's just an edge of emotion that wasn't there for some reason.
I thought the film was quite powerful. There were lots of scenes that I found yeah. personally very hard to watch. It's very impressive technically. The attack on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, then the build-up, there's a lot of tension,
yeah.
lots of really good dialogue between the characters mm-hmm. as they...
Yeah, the dialogue is very natural as well. Maybe, you know, maybe we are.
The performances are great.
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it? Well, I'm not giving it more than 7.
I mean, I could give it an 8 quite comfortably. I think the main thing is, though, that we maybe feel a little bit disconnected from yeah. it. It doesn't try to engage us as much as we would yeah. like. And it presents the facts as they were. So we appreciate it and enjoyed it, but it's not lingered in our memory.
We enjoyed it a little less than Henry VIII, which we've just recorded.
Yeah.
Does that feel about right?
I would say.
I think I probably got a little less than good. I feel slightly...
It seems mean, but...
It does. It feels all wrong that I could be engaged about the Battle of Agincourt 1415 more than the events of Selma Bridge. But anyway, there you go.
But I genuinely would recommend it. Would you recommend it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but really, I mean, it's a very enjoyable movie to go and see. There is plenty of tension and drama in it. And, you know, it's an evening well spent.
It's currently on Netflix. So if you're already subscribed to that, it's free.
Yeah.
I would really recommend it. It's very good. Accuracy-wise, I was going to say a 9.
I'm going to rely on you for that.
Okay. I think with all the support we've seen, and you can argue about a few little things, it's a 9.
Okay. Great. Okay. Anything else we need to say about it then? Or shall we have Wolf and David's roundup?
Yeah, it's time for a roundup from Henry V.
From Henry V. And well, do you know what? With Henry V, we have a new leader on the most popular board. 88% of you who have seen it love this film. And that beats our other 80%ers, The Madness of King George, Battle of Algiers, and The Lion in Winter. I am faintly surprised. But then, I was also faintly surprised at how much I enjoyed the film too, so maybe it all comes together. Kathleen had been, just like me this time round, surprised to be hooked. And I share Kathleen's fascination with Henry V, the man, or machine, as may be a better term. Joy and I then had that argument, traditional argument, about the bard and his comedy skills, or lack of them, and I have a slightly depressed feeling that Joy's going to turn out to be right, at which point the last vestige of my personality will have gone. Some of the reason, I think, for the Henry V enthusiasm has got to be that speech, of course, does it not? You know the one, we few, we happy few, and all that. That was referred to a lot. William had been inspired by it and inspired a team to victory with it. And I don't think you're alone, William. It doesn't do to lose your cool, but it is almost impossible to avoid a tingle when you say that speech, isn't it? Some of you were also very keen about Kenneth. He got very high ratings, actually, despite the disaster that was his haircut. I was a little bit worried about Fiona and the thin lips thing, but, you know, Catherine is of the same mind in terms of an actor, although thin lips didn't get mentioned, it's got to be said. This led to something of a debate about English actors, with a tremendous and absolutely iconic gif of the peerless Brian Blessed from Ben, which I love and look at daily when I get a moment. Patrick just put up a picture of Paul Schofield, which is sufficient, it has to be said. But Sarah mentioned Tom Hiddleston, of course, not in this movie. And there was a really good recent series on the Beeb called The Hollow Crown, a series of, you know, Shakespeare's history plays, which is largely responsible for my conversion to the bard and his history plays. The name I forgot in the podcast, don't know if you remember that I forgot a name, but I did, was Ben Whishaw. Ben Whishaw, who in that series did the perfect, the perfect Richard II. Seriously, The Hollow Crown with Ben Whishaw. Watch it if you can. He does a fantastic job. Plus, of course, you get the This Precious Stone set in a silver sea speech, which is a cracker. So, a lot of love for the bard from everybody. A lot of love for Brenar. And less outrage about the abandonment of Dear Dear Larry than I expected. The last word, though, probably needs to go to Lewis, of course, who simply noted, for Wolf's benefit, that it's a good film, you know, but no Crimson Tide.
Okay, well done me.
Well done me.
Why well done you?
Well, I led the episode.
I was just talking about the roundup.
Oh. Well done for the roundup and well done me for the episode.
Well done you for the episode.
Thank you for being here, David.
Well, it was good to be invited. Anyway, should we stop blathering and stop?
Yes.
Okay. Bye, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Thanks for coming. Bye. 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 Bye.
Are you not entertained?
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.